Hello, this is Julianne Good, and you're listening to Psych 101. Welcome. We are here to make psychology more understandable with tips for you, your family, and friends to make your lives easier. Tonight, my special guest is in studio, and this is Dr. Trevor A. Daniels, and we are going to be talking about the psychological impact of police violence. It has been in the news lately. It has been a concern for many citizens as to what is happening in the United States concerning police violence. And Dr. Trevor A. Daniels is a clinically trained community psychologist who specializes in diversity and multiculturalism. He earned his doctorate from the California School of Professional Psychology and also holds psychology degrees from Miami University in Oxford, Ohio, and Antioch University in Los Angeles. Trevor has worked extensively in both administrative and clinical roles in mental health and with substance use disorders over the past 20 years. For more than a decade, he has taught clinical psychology at the graduate level and has been involved with several local and national groups, lending expertise to community planning, HIV health and science literacy, and issues of cultural competency. Currently, Dr. Daniels is developing a private consulting corporation which collaborates with communities in strengthening all levels of relational dynamics through capacity building, advocacy, and informed engagement. Welcome, Dr. Daniels. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for being here. This is a very interesting and impactful topic that we're going to get into this evening.
Yeah, it is. And actually, when we discussed, you know, doing this topic, you know, I was sort of all over the place and didn't know where to start. It's very complex. And so we never... There's just a lot of, you know, different ways we can go. So hopefully your listeners will get a lot out of it.
Well, I think so. I mean, we've all heard the news stories and have been shocked at how much has been going on. You know, the police shootings and beatings of citizens, and it's been impacting all of us from coast to coast.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the big question that everyone is asking is, you know, is there, you know, some type of rise in, you know, in police violence? So I think just the sheer magnitude of what's happened and, you know, death after death after death, you know, people are a little scared. And not just Black people, not just Hispanic or Latino people, but all people, you know, what's happening with the police. So yeah, it's been a very impactful thing from coast to coast, and I would even argue all over the world.
Yes, most definitely. Now, how did you get into doing this type of research?
I don't do, you know, the formalized research per se, but, you know, like you introduced me, I am trained as a community psychologist. So community psychologists, you know, we can do a wide range of things or work with a wide range of issues. And so because my specialization is specifically multiculturalism, I'm more apt to be involved in issues of racism, discrimination, you know, violence in communities. So I became interested, you know, just in this particular topic because so many people are talking about it and it seems like, you know, there has been a rise. And just, you know, walking through the streets, you see so many young African-American men and even some young African-American women, you know, who have these skulls on their face because, you know, there's, you know, this anger or the perception that people are out to get them. If you are interacting with a lot of older African-Americans, especially those who were around in the 60s and the 50s, you know, you hear these stories about police violence or just violence against Blacks in communities. And so, you know, at least for me, it has piqued my interest. And I wanted to talk a little bit about it because there is a part of the dialogue that I think that needs to happen that we don't hear. And I think, you know, if we're just talking about police in the U.S., we have to be clear, you know, I hear people talking all the time about the criminal justice system. Mm-hmm. And usually when they're talking about the criminal justice system, they're talking about uniform police. But the criminal justice system is really one, it's a catch-all term, and the police are just one part of that. So when you're talking about the criminal justice system, you're talking about the police, you're talking about the courts, you're talking about prisons. And we also need to be clear that the police are not totally responsible for, you know, the safety of the people. It's a shared responsibility between those three entities. And really, the police are really responsible for identification, apprehension, and detection of violators of the law. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what their responsibility is, generally speaking. And, you know, I might add that another responsibility might be that of crime prevention. So, you know, we just need to be clear right off the bat what that is. And also, you know, I was thinking, so how did the police get its start, you know, mm-hmm. in the U.S.? And so I was surprised to find that, you know, to understand that we needed to go all the way back to colonial times in America. So, you know, hundreds of years ago, and really the police, the modern police, grew out of social need, basically. Mm-hmm. You know, that the emergence of cities and towns. That's how the police got its start. And really, as we find advances in society, whether it's just how we relate to each other or technology, the role of the police change. So really, you know, the police are here out of, you know, social necessity.
Right.
And that's, you know, basically it. Now, what that has turned into, you know, is hopefully we can discuss some of that, you know, today.
Right. And luckily, too, it's smaller segments of the officers. I think there are still a major portion of our officers that are going out. They are doing a dangerous job every day. Mm-hmm. They are protecting us citizens, you know, from the bad guys. I have one friend that is a police officer, and he does gang intervention down in Santa Ana. So does a great job. So we also have to bring those, you know, our everyday heroes into the picture also. It's just a small portion that is being, you know, honed in on by the media. And, you know, the numbers are increasing. So we want to look really at both sides of the coin here.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. It's important to recognize that, one, you know, I'm not here to vilify police or even, you know, tell the police how to do their jobs. And two, yeah, you know, there are police officers, a lot of police officers and law enforcement officers who are really good. So this isn't about, you know, saying all U.S. police are bad, racist, you know, what have you. It is a dangerous job. If you live in a big city like Los Angeles, and if you walk the streets, there are dangerous people. Mm-hmm. There are dangerous areas.
We're in one right now.
We're in one right
yes.
now. You know, I live in, you know, the Rampart Division, you know, area. And I remember when I first moved to Los Angeles, 16 years ago this summer, Rampart Police Department was all over the news, mm-hmm. You know, for police violence. And I live two blocks from, you know, that police station right now. And so every time I walk past it, I have memories of what I was hearing on the news. And I think they were discussing closing it down because it was just, you know, so many problems. But I also have to say, in that same neighborhood, you know, I was walking around one day and there was a shrine up, you know, in front of an apartment building of someone who had been murdered like 2 days before. And interestingly enough, they were trying to rent apartments. And I said, well, you know, I don't think that shrine is going to help you any type of way. So, so, you know, there are many dangerous areas where maybe, you know, force by police is justified. And maybe someone is going to get hurt or killed. You know, that's sort of the nature of the beast. But, you know, we also do have to talk about, you know, those times when maybe there's excessive force, mm-hmm. And, you know, how people who are unarmed end up dead.
Yes. You know? As we were talking about before, probably, you know, I have an article here from Journalist Resource, and they were listing some of the more mediaized stories lately. The one that was most shocking to me was the 12-year-old that was shot in Cleveland, Ohio. He had a toy pistol and shot in the mm-hmm. park. That just, when I heard that, you know, the week that happened, my heart just dropped. I'm like, what is happening here?
Yeah.
How can we prevent this from happening somehow? I mean, you know, I think it's a good thing for having the rights if the rights do not turn violent themselves, because then that's just, you know, violence does not beget violence, period.
Right. And I think that shooting actually happened the same day or a day after, you know, a couple of days after, you know, one of the other ones that was, you know, in the news.
Right.
And interestingly enough, I am from Northeast Ohio. Oh. So I was, you know, very interested when I heard that story. Yeah, I think a lot of people were amazed. And I, like, the day after it happened, I was being driven by one of the car services, you know, to a meeting or something. And the driver was African-American. And, you know, we were driving through downtown Los Angeles and they were talking about this story because I hadn't even heard about it. Mm-hmm. And the way that the person was talking about it, you know, it was just like all white people are bad, all police are bad. And I think one of the things that sticks out for me is how, you know, our perceptions of other people or institutions facilitate certain behavior.
Mm-hmm, yes.
And so you're talking about, you know, all these stories of dangerous people, you know, riots, what have you, and you are a police officer and you're driving through the park, or where I think this happened, that the kid was in a park.
He was, yes.
And you see someone from a distance that looks like they have a gun,
mm-hmm.
And you can't tell whether the gun is real or not. And so what kind of thinking sort of facilitates, you know, shooting the person? You know, none of us were there. We don't know what happened, but how did we go from seeing this kid, with something that looks like a gun, I don't know if it's real or not, to the kid being dead? And so in a lot of these instances, that's what we really need to get to. And doing research for the show today, I was looking at, research on stress,
mm-hmm.
and you sort of think, well, you know, how does stress sort of play into all of this? What we've been hearing over and over is, I was in fear of my life. And so when you think about stress or the stress reaction, people usually think about the feeling that they have in their body. You know, they are confronted with something, you know, maybe it's something that really is dangerous. And so the flight or fight, you know, response is kicked up, or you're sitting in the classroom like my students and I want to see how they're going to react. So I say, oh, you know, I forgot to tell you there's going to be an exam. And you see the color drain out of everyone's face. Well, in that instance, what has really facilitated, you know, the feeling inside the body is everything that they thought, you know, when I told them about, you know, this test that was going to happen. So if you sort of transfer that to seeing something that looks like a gun from a distance, you know, we have all of these thoughts. And, you know, what they call sort of appraisals, you know, of the situation that actually facilitates, you know, this thing that we call stress, which then facilitates some type of reaction. So if you're talking about someone who is in a dangerous job, who has been given the ability, you know, to handcuff, to shoot, to kill, to do whatever, it sort of makes sense that somebody is going to get shot. It makes sense that you see somebody in a park with a gun, you know, whether they're 12 or 25, it makes sense that that person may get shot and killed.
Mm-hmm.
And so again, it's the nature of the beast. And so there's a larger question, you know, that has to be asked. There's a lot that has to be looked at. you know, the way in which we, you know, set up these, you know, police organizations or policing bodies and the rights that we give police, mm-hmm. You know, is that the conversation that we need to have, or do we just need to talk about violent police?
I think we need to talk about it all. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's part of the reason for doing this is let's look into it a little bit deeper. Let's bring up a few more of the issues that may not be talked about, because when I watch the news, it seems to be the sensationalism mm-hmm. of it, mm-hmm. you know, and I mean, it doesn't make any difference which news network it is. It's just let's bring out the worst possible scenario instead of talking about what happened before, what happened mm-hmm. during, what happened after, what led up to, you know, the police violence.
Right. And so to your first point, yeah, the point is that this issue is more complex than violent police officers. Yes, you know, that is a serious issue, but we have to take it all in context. So that's a great point. And then, you know, the second thing is the sensationalization of you know, this violence. And you're right. So the news is in the business of ratings and getting awards and, you know, and viewers and all that type of stuff. And so we have to be careful when we are watching the news, and especially some news stations that I won't name. But, you know, we have to be careful because we don't know what happened before. We don't know what happened after. A lot of news stations now have, you know, this thing where you can text in your pictures or your videos and get this play-by-play, you know, type of deal. But again, who's sending in the information? Mm-hmm. We tend to pay attention only to those things that sort of fit, you know, with how we think, you know, the world works. So is the information that we get from the news, you know, how is it biased?
Yes.
You know, of course it's biased, but, yes. you know, the question is, how is it biased?
Mm-hmm.
So if we have someone who, you know, is a vigilante, for example, you know, what piece of what they see are they going to report? You know, how are we internalizing what we see? How do we conceptualize it? And when we are recounting, you know, the story, you know, how are we doing that? So all of this stuff, you know, comes into play, and it's not a simple deal of, you know, this, you know, is what happened. You know, here is the picture.
Right.
Here is the video clip. Here is the sound bite.
Right. You really need to question mm-hmm. and not just take it for face value.
Absolutely. Which is what we want to do. But psychology tells us that, you know, our mind, or at the very least the way in which we are conceptualizing things, it doesn't happen at face value.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we want to take things at face value. You know, that's what I saw on the clip. But because we have all of these, you know, cultural dialogues, you know, and we have these identities that guide everything that we think and that we do, those are helping us, you know, make these stories around what we've seen, which may or may not be true.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And we're also overloaded with information nowadays. So we're trying to get our as much information and news as possible within a few seconds mm-hmm. daily
mm-hmm.
instead of being able to say, let's look into this a little bit deeper and what's happening. So when we come back from commercial, let's dig into a little bit the statistics and what may be going on the end of the police officers who are involved in these crimes.
Okay.
The Chicago School of Professional Psychology offers numerous psychology, behavioral, and health-related science graduate degrees at three campuses: Los Angeles, California, including branches in Westwood and Irvine, Chicago, Illinois, and Washington, D.C., and online. The Chicago School prepares students to meet the ever-changing mental health needs of society through classroom experience and real-world training. The Chicago School Counseling Centers in Irvine and Westwood provide caring, confidential, and affordable psychological services to individuals and their families. For more information, visit thechicagoschool.edu.
And thank you to the Chicago School of Professional Psychology for sponsoring Psych One-on-One. This is Julianne Good, and I am back with Dr. Trevor Daniels, and we are talking about the impact of police violence that is going on in our country right now. Now, Dr. Daniels, what are the statistics on the deaths recently from police violence?
Well, interestingly enough, I found The Guardian, you know, online has set up this database, which is called The Counted. And what it does is it's tallying the number of people killed at the hands of police in the U.S. throughout 2015. Now, when I was thinking about, you know, this show, I can get very professorial. And so I didn't want to bombard your listeners with statistics. But as of, I think, about 2:50 Pacific time today, the number was 607.
Wow.
So the number of deaths of, you know, citizens at the hands of the police. And the way that they have this database set up is it's looking at whites versus Latinos, Hispanics, as they list them, and Black. The large proportion of the people being killed are Black at roughly 4 per million citizens, as compared to 1.5 and 1.7 persons per million if you're looking at whites and Latino Hispanics, respectively. So even in this database, and you can go on, you know, the Guardian's website, and, you know, it explains, you know, where this information is coming from and what the project is about. But even, you know, in this database, you know, Blacks are still disproportionately, you know, victims of violence. And that keeps happening, you know, over and over, no matter who's doing the research. Well, if the research is credible and scientific, Blacks are disproportionately affected, you know, by violence.
And they are incarcerated at higher levels also than other races.
Absolutely. And so, you know, what this tells me is we can't ignore you know, the fact that Blacks are being disproportionately affected. And it's, you know, and typically, you know, what happens a lot of times is, you know, people will say, well, you know, that's not really true, or, you know, they try to discount it or what have you. But if the research keeps telling us that Blacks are disproportionately impacted, then Blacks are disproportionately impacted. And I think we just need to accept that and now do something about it.
Exactly. And what are some of your thoughts on that racial divide?
Well, I'm often torn because I know that race does matter. Mm-hmm. You know, thank you, Cornel West. You know, race does matter. Mm-hmm. But I like to caution people not to chalk it all up to race. Because it is a very complex issue. Connie Rice, you know, and she's known well here in Los Angeles and nationally, you know, for taking the LAPD to task. She gave an interview on NPR in 2014 on this show called Code Switching. And she sort of said the same thing. And so I was glad, you know, to hear a prominent African-American who, you know, works, you know, in this area, you know, say, hey, we can't just say, you know, everyone is racist and this is all about race. Race does matter. And what I always like to point out, you know, especially the students and people that I am training, is that, and I said this earlier, we do have these racial cultural legacies that dictate how we think about ourselves, how we think about other groups of people, and how we treat them. Mm-hmm. So when you're talking about, you know, this racial divide, the one thing that we have to remember is that while we can't say that every, you know, police officer or every white person is racist. While we can't say that, and, you know, it's even illogical to think that, what we can say is that race does matter, and what we think about race, our own and others, has influence in how we're treating people and how we think about the critical issues. And so that's another one of those areas where, you know, people really have to accept, you know, that your whiteness, Julianne, and my blackness facilitates how we are interacting with each other right now. Although, you know, it's very collegial and things like that, you know, both of us may be having certain thoughts or certain assumptions about who the other person is just based on what our experiences have been. Mm-hmm. About a week ago, I was talking with someone who wants, you know, to do this video project. And this is a Caucasian male who's about 30 years old. And what he was saying was, I want to empower young people. And he was pretty much talking about minority young people to do something better in their lives. And he went on to say, because everyone, you know, these young kids are walking around thinking that everyone is out to get them. And I said, well, you know, you need to be careful how you think about that. Because for people who live in very, you know, violent areas or areas where, you know, there's a lot of poverty, it may be that their experience of other people, namely whites, has been that they've been out to get them. Mm-hmm. So for them, that's actually true.
Yeah, negative impact over and over again. And you're right, it does have a lot to do with the socioeconomic status of a person also. There's so much that goes into it. It's just not literally and figuratively face value, period.
Right. You know, often, you know, when we're talking about the racial divide, you know, people want to talk about, well, you know, we need to do something, you know, where the black folk and the white folk, you know, can understand each other better and, you know, and create these alliances and, you know, and create trust. Well, yeah, that does need to happen, but it's much more complicated than that.
Yes.
You're talking about, you know, hundreds of years of, you know, violence being discounted, you know, being killed, what have you, treated like chattel. And you just can't erase that by having a meeting, you know, where you have people, you know, shaking hands and, you know, and doing exercises to build trust. Mm-hmm. You know, it's much more complex.
Right.
Than that.
Right. So now with the rise in police violence, do you think it's just what's happening within the police force, or do you think it's a combination of that and just the rise in violence overall in this country?
Good question. I actually sometimes wonder if there is not a rise in police violence. Is it that, you know, we're just hearing about the most egregious, you know, acts of violence? Mm-hmm. You know, how are we defining violence? So, you know, it seems like this year, you know, there's been death after death after death of unarmed black men. So that story in and of itself is not new. Mm-hmm. We often hear parents talking about, you know, the talk they have with their black sons about how they need to act in public because you might get killed, you know, just for walking down the street. So that story isn't new. I think what happens is we have these egregious stories, and this year it just seems back to back to back. There's riots, which also, you know, begets violence, and we think, you know, that there is an increase. I'm not sure that there really is an increase. And I would, you know, ask the question that I would ask back is, what about all of those other areas of violence or types of violence that we don't hear about? So, of course, we're going to hear about the unarmed person who gets killed by the police. But there's all different types of violence. And so how are we defining violence? And are we looking at those instances as well? I think what really needs to, I mean, that's concerning. So unarmed people, you know, getting killed. But what really scares me is the reaction that we get from people in the public.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So, you know, listen to how people are responding, you know, to, you know, the fact that someone did get killed who was unarmed. Mm-hmm. And of course, you get people, you know, online because of anonymity, you know, who say the most outrageous things. But even if we go back to the media, you know what they report. Well, he was once arrested for smoking marijuana. He was once, you know, arrested for domestic violence. So it's almost like suggesting, well, you know, the fact that he got killed, you know, was warranted. Look, you know, he's a drug user, or he's domestically violent. So we live in a violent society. Mm-hmm. We also, you know, give the police the right to shoot people, to handcuff them. You know, both you and I are clinicians. You know, in some places we do restraints. Mm-hmm. you know, so we live in a violent society. You know, there's these debates about, you know, the violent video games. One day I was walking through my neighborhood. And when you get to some of the areas of Los Angeles, and I would imagine that, you know, you see this in a lot of large metropolises. When you get into those areas that are predominantly Black or Hispanic or some other ethnic racial persuasion other than white, you start to see a lot of the check cashing places and mm-hmm. the payday loan places.
Yes.
And one day I was walking down the street down, you know, 6th Street just outside of downtown, and this police car swooped up and, you know, jumped up on the sidewalk, and the police officers jumped out. Both of them had shotguns, and you hear them, you know, do the thing to get mm-hmm. ready to shoot. Talking. And yeah, and everybody's sort of looking around like, what's going on? Nobody was running. We didn't hear any alarms. So the other question is, you know, rules of engagement. You know, do we shoot first and ask questions later? Or does the way in which we address, you know, some type of crime or potential crime, is it in proportion to what's actually happening? Mm-hmm. So if, you know, police officers are cocking shotguns down the street, I would expect to hear an alarm, you know, people screaming. But it was just, it seemed like a regular day.
just a regular day
yeah,
in downtown
and,
LA.
And then, you know, yeah, exactly. So it seemed like a regular day. And all of a sudden you have two police officers standing in front of you with shotguns going into a building ready to shoot. And no one heard any type of alarm or any type of warning that anything was happening. Mm-hmm. So when you live in those, you know, in areas where that type of thing happens, you know, it makes sense that people are going to, you know, die, get hurt. You know, it's a part of some people's everyday existence.
Yeah, that's mm-hmm. true. Sadly enough, living on the edge.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Now, I thought this was interesting. I did a little research on my end also from a magazine that was online called The Police Chief, the professional voice of law enforcement. This is written by Brian D. Fitch, the lieutenant of the L.A. County Sheriff's Department. Mm-hmm. And he was discussing what was the understanding, the psychology of police misconduct. And I thought this was pretty interesting because, of course, again, luckily, we're talking about a small segment of the police force, the ones, you know, that getting into the news here. And he wrote about what's called rationalizing misconduct.
Yeah.
One of them, and I'll just go through these really quick because I thought this was pretty fascinating. But this is what he thought was some of the mentality of the officers that he's worked with and the ones that have gotten into trouble with the department. One of the strategies was denial of the victim, and it's alleging that because there is no legitimate victim, there is no misconduct.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The next one was victim of circumstance. They're behaving improperly because the officer had no other choice, either because of peer pressure or unethical supervision. The next was denial of injury. Because nobody was hurt by the officer's action, no misconduct actually occurred. Then you have the advantageous comparisons, minimizing or excusing one's own wrongdoing by comparing it to the more egregious behavior of others. If somebody else is doing it, hey, why should I, be any different here? Or the higher cause, breaking the rules because of some higher calling, that is removing a known felon from the streets. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So they're going to be the judge and the jury on the streets, basically, unless, of course, I mean, it's a known felon and they're, on the most wanted list or whatever. Mm-hmm. They have a history. They already have the information that's hardcore in front of them. I think then it's a different situation with that. The next one is blame the victim. The victim invited any suffering or misconduct by breaking the law in the first place.
Right.
Which I work with rehab clients, and a lot of them have been in that situation.
Right. And the interesting thing, well, first of all, what you're talking about is cognitive dissonance.
Right.
Which is what we all do, to some degree. And basically what it is when we step across the line, we justify, our actions. Well, I did this because. Now, in the last one, victim blaming, it's interesting because in some of these instances of death at the hands of police, we don't know if anyone had committed a crime. Again, we have, the police being, judge and jury. And if you remember when we started off the show, I said that the role of the police in general is to, detect, apprehend, people who may, be, violating the law. So in some cases, we don't know if a law has been broken. And so, when we talked the other day, I was thinking, well, who's the most recent, person who's been, killed by the police? And so there was this guy in Alabama, I think. His name was Anthony Dwayne Ware. And someone called. He was sitting on a neighbor's porch or something like that. So the story goes, with a gun. Someone called the police. He ran into the woods. The police ran after him. And the next thing, he's dead. What crime was being committed? But I think, that the justification for shooting him was maybe he didn't put down the gun when they asked him to, or he charged at them and they pepper sprayed him and that didn't work. And so then they shot him and now he's dead. So, yeah. And cognitive, dissonance is, we find that in what we call attribution bias. And what attribution bias is, it's how we explain our behavior versus the behavior of others. And so what's interesting about attribution bias is that when we are talking about our behavior, especially, when we've stepped across the line, the reason that we've done that is always external. Mm-hmm. I did it because I was in fear of my life. When we are talking about the behavior of others, we usually attribute internal factors. Well, they were a criminal. They have this history of being arrested, for drug use or for domestic violence or whatever. So, that's why they did X, Y, and Z. That's why they've ended up dead. So we need to, look at that and listen, to the reasons that peacekeepers are giving, for, violent acts against other people. And again, I go back to this thing about the rules of engagement. Are actions proportionate to what's actually happening at the time, that the action is taking place? Mm-hmm. And it seems to me, and again, I will say I haven't done extensive research on this. It seems to me that, you know, in a lot of instances, it's shoot first and ask questions later, or put it in a chokehold and ask questions later. Well, you know, at the end of that scenario, you know, only one side can answer questions.
Right. And I think us as a general public need to have more questions answered. Mm-hmm. What exactly did happen here, instead of filling in the blank spots with, you know, whatever we're going to preconceive about what possibly may have happened with this crime, you know, and just being left in the dark, basically.
And unfortunately, that's what happens in a lot of these cases. Yes. We are left in the dark.
Yes. Mm-hmm. We will come back in a few minutes, and we will finish up talking about the impact of police violence.
Are you searching for answers and insight to life issues? Is the behavior of family or friends questionable or concerning? Find tips and possible solutions from the convenience of your own PC, cell phone, or tablet at therapycable.com. Therapy Cable has the most comprehensive library of contemporary therapy videos online. Help may be as easy as a few clicks away. Therapy Cable offers comprehensive therapy videos ranging from addiction to self-care and contact information for qualified providers. Find the answers to your life challenges at therapycable.com.
Welcome back to Psych 101 with Julianne Good and Dr. Trevor Daniels. And we are going to wrap up talking about the impact of police violence, the psychology behind it. And what are your final thoughts on this, Dr. Daniels?
Well, my final thoughts are, and the reason I really want to have this discussion, and hopefully, you know, we can have a, you know, lengthier discussions and more discussions, is because we only hear one side of you know, the issue. You know, there's a lot of violence at the hand of police. People are getting killed. And, you know, specifically, you know, unarmed Black people or just Black people in general are being killed disproportionately at the hand of police, and we need to do something about it. That is an extremely serious issue.
Yes.
But we also have to remember that the issue of police violence exists in context. And this begs us to rethink whether or not this is simply a police issue or basically a societal issue. And if that is the case, then we all have to take responsibility for it. And so we have to understand, you know, what I call the ecology of systems. You know, the police are just one part of this larger community. And really, we live in a violent society, and we endorse this violence. First of all, we sanction law enforcement, officers to handcuff, carry guns, shotguns, et cetera. We have stand your ground, you know, in some places, you know, community and media responses. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we just live in a violent society. We also need to reconcile the larger internal conflicts that we seem to hold around the issue of violence. So attributional bias, we just got finished talking about. So, you know, we're conflicted. And so then we justify, you know, why we've done what we've done, or we try to justify why someone is now dead, you know, because of their past, without even knowing the full story of the reason why they're dead. How do we keep the momentum going? So there have been a lot of riots, a lot of violence, a lot of, you know, conversations and other types of dialogue around, you know, this police violence. But are we only having those when unarmed Black people are being killed? Mm-hmm. You know, so how do we keep the momentum going? How do we define violence? You know, are we only outraged because unarmed people are being killed, or a disproportionate number of Black people are being killed? Or are we just do we need to be outraged about, you know, violence in general?
I think in general, mm-hmm. I think we need to reassess this as communities and start talking about this until before another tragedy happens.
Right. Absolutely. And on that note, you know, intervention has to take place at all levels of our system. It's not just about, you know, the police. You know, what responsibility does the average Joe, the average citizen have?
Right.
What needs to happen, you know, with policymakers? What about our academic institutions, you know, schools? You know, they're all different levels. You know, this needs to happen. How do we inform, you know, the public? How do we build alliances? How do we address people's fears? I was downtown about a week ago with a friend, and we walked into the store, and, you know, the people that owned this store, I don't know, I think they were maybe Chinese or, you know, or some member of some Asian, one of the Asian groups, and they were almost throwing the stuff at us, you know, that we were buying because they wanted us out of the store. You know, they wouldn't touch the money. And when the lady had to give me, you know, my change back, she threw it at me. You know, they were pushing the goods. They wouldn't even give us a bag. And it was like, okay, get out. Mm-hmm. You know, I encounter that a lot.
Yeah. I've definitely have seen that type of behavior in downtown LA too.
Yeah.
It's just such a level of general mistrust mm-hmm. between
Absolutely.
The cultures. It's disturbing to see mm-hmm. sometimes.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it is just blatantly out there.
Absolutely. And it's, you know, I shop at the 99 cent store sometimes. I even get followed around the 99 cent store. And it's like, really? 99 cents. you know, so it happens everywhere.
Right.
And, you know, and lastly, you know, there does need to be reform in how the police, how they do their work. And again, you know, I'm not a criminal justice expert, and, you know, far be it for me to tell the police how to do their work, but there definitely needs to be reform because this is just happening too much, period. And so I don't think anyone, you know, in their right mind who can form who can have a very, informed opinion can say that there isn't a problem here.
Mm-hmm.
So there does need to be reform. Now, what that, reform is, I don't know. And I'll add to that, that with any intervention, we have to expect that there's going to be unintended consequences. Now, if you can sort of, think about it and extrapolate, one of the reasons that we are having this discussion right now is because police don't do what they did when we originally, the police, the institution of, police was established. Mm-hmm. And that's, walking the streets, of our neighborhood when, police stations were sort of geographical. They were in neighborhoods. People knew the police officer because he was, he was walking the streets. He knew what was going on. Mm-hmm. But as soon as, you get shortwave radios, cars, cities grow, now they're driving around and they become further and further removed from the public. And so now the interaction is only, when there's a problem.
That's a good point because, I grew up in a small town and we knew a lot of the police officers because it was just, that's the way it was. So you knew, they used to make visits to the schools and said, if you have any problems, here we are. And you knew them by Officer Smith or so-and-so, mm-hmm. but you knew their faces. So there was more of a personalization to the whole protection. They're part of the communities. They're the ones that are supposed to be overseeing that, if there's any problems, give them a call. And then they started being villainized,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And their reputation with the general public started deteriorating to the point where a lot of people, I love this in LA. They see a cop car and everybody slows down like that.
Yeah.
Heartbeat. It's just like, okay, they're out to get me. I better slow down to 65 or else if I go 66, I'm going to get, pulled over or whatever.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden there's this almost general paranoia going on. And instead of realizing that yes, they do a dangerous job that most of us would not sign on for. And they do extensive testing and a lot of psychological testing before they hire, a lot of the officers.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They still do that. They invest a lot in the training and the testing.
Right. And I have a colleague that I worked with, when I was an intern who we were interns together who does that. Works for, LAPD, as a psychologist. So, it's interesting. And I talked earlier about the advent of technology and how that, sort of changes, the police role. But, right. When you look back and see that they really used to walk the street and know the people that lived, it seems almost ridiculous and like that never happened. But it actually did.
Right, exactly. Yeah. In the old days. Dr. Daniels, if anybody would like to contact you, how can they do so?
They can reach me by email at drtadaniels@gmail.com. That's doctor spelled out, drtadaniels@gmail.com.
Great. Thank you so much for being on. It was a very interesting segment.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. And thank you so much for joining me on Psych 1-on-1. This podcast will be downloaded onto iTunes Store within 24 to 48 hours. And there are also about 100 other shows on different themes on psychology. I'd love you to check them out. If you would like to contact me, you can do so at jgoode8@verizon.net. My business number is 562-234-4650, and my office is in Irvine, California. Thank you so much. I would love to hear from you. Thank you so much, Cheyenne Hayes, for being my board op. Thank you so much, Jeremy Hansen, for being our executive producer. And thank you, and take care of yourself. Take care of each other. Bye now.